The journey to a smoke-free future can be a long and winding road, but if you're ready for a change, consider taking Zyn for a spin. Zyn nicotine pouches offer a fresh way to discover your nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. No smoke, no spit, and no lingering odor. Get in gear with the Zyn 10 Challenge and enjoy 10 smoke-free, spit-free days for just $5.95. Order online and start your new journey today. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro potting soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro potting soil, just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Talk, yeah. Singing, yeah.
I'm great at that.
You talk in rhythm. You just talk like, you know, 20 right. minutes ago, I am free like a breeze, free like a bird in the woodland wild, free like a gypsy, free like a child. I am unattached. It's just that kind of, you know. So anyway, Trevor Nunn was directing Oklahoma on Broadway. It was the National
Brush
Theater.
Up. Your Shakespeare starts.
Yeah, exactly.
Now. Yes, I'm great at that.
Yeah, there you go. So you're great. Hi, I'm Asif Manvi, and I am an actor, a writer, a father, a son. But what I am not is Cal Penn.
Hello and welcome, everybody. That's right. This is a brand new episode of Off the Beat, and I am your host, Brian Baumgartner. Today's guest, well, he has been a staple of nightly television for close to a decade, and he was once almost arrested in a two-headed fish costume. I am talking, of course, about film, TV, and daily show icon, Asif Manvi. Now, Asif and I have a lot in common. We both wrote a book, we both love the theater, and we both might start breaking into song. So I loved every minute of diving into Asif's past and his start as an actor. He was a child born in India who moved to England and then to Florida. So Asif calls himself a human turducken. And it was fascinating for me to hear how his childhood as an immigrant became later rich material for his career. We even hear a few insider secrets about what's really going on at Walt Disney World. Intrigued? I am. You're not going to want to miss this one. Asif Manvi, everyone.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every morning, left over from the night before.
Hello.
Hey.
Asif, how are you?
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. I don't think we've ever met before.
I don't think we've ever met either, which is weird because I find you so funny and delightful.
Thanks.
And we have, well, I know I'm just kissing your ass right now, but.
I understand though. A lot of people kiss my ass.
Yeah.
That's great. I likewise, I feel like I didn't realize it was you when they originally told me about this podcast. And then I Googled it, and then I was like, oh, wait, that's so great. The, you know, like, it's so weird in this business. Like, you think that we would run into each other at some point, but, you know.
Yes, I know. I'm sure I saw you, like, across the Emmys 3 or 4 times, but no one was nice enough to introduce us, I'm guessing. Well, and we've worked with so many of the same people, too.
That's true. So this is fun. You're doing this podcast.
I'm doing this podcast. I'm talking to people that I like about their life and about the sort of unexpected moments that take our careers or your career on different trajectories. I think it's fascinating in this business how, well, I mean, we'll talk about you. First of all, you born in India, and then you moved to England very early. And then eventually to the United States. How was that for you to grow up kind of in so many different places?
Well, I often have described myself as a human turducken.
Okay.
Which is, so you know what a turducken is? It's like a duck.
Yes. Stuffed it's inside like the, a chicken. The turkey with the chicken.
And the duck. Right.
Yes.
So I've often described myself that way because I feel like there's like an Indian baby with an English schoolboy wrapped in an American adult. That's kind of what I feel like sometimes, you know? Like, so I was born in India, and of course, that was, you know, I don't have any really memory of that, but, you know, grew up in an Indian, Indian family with that cultural piece and that heritage and that thing. And then grew up in the north of England, sort of like this little English public school kid. So my childhood and all of my formative years and like all the TV shows I watched between like 5 and 16 were all like English shows. And I was a little British boy and then came to America and of all places moved to Tampa, Florida, which is as America as you can get, really, you know. So
it is. I've been to Tampa. I know exactly what you mean. Right. Yes.
So it's like I come from like the north of England, like a coal mining, textile, wool factory, dirty, sort of the sky is gray all the time, even in summer town, and moved from there to Florida, which is just like a...
Right.
It's not even like Miami. It's like, you know, it doesn't even have like a a culture of its own, you know, like a whatever that is. But it's Tampa. I'd never even heard of it before, you know.
But before Tampa, why a coal mining English town? Was this your parents' dream or work or how did you end up there?
My dad was a coal miner. He was
okay.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't. My dad's dream was to go down the coal mine, he was like a little Indian boy. He was like, one day I will work in a coal mine. And so that's a great little short film. I'll just sell that idea to Netflix.
There you go.
He's an Indian kid, grew up in Bombay, but his dream was to be a coal miner.
In the north of England.
In the north of England.
No doubt. Yeah.
No, my dad got a job at Bradford University of all places because he was a color chemist at the time, which was a thing at the time.
Okay.
This was in the late 60s. And so, it was like moving to England, better life, you know, all that stuff.
Right.
I don't think my parents realized, they didn't do much research. Like there was no Google. They didn't like Google Bradford back then. And go, what's the weather like there? You know, so they show up in this like cold, wintry, northern English town.
Yeah.
And that's where I was raised. But also it happens that Bradford also has a very large, and I think even today has a very large Indian Pakistani population for some reason.
Oh,
so
really?
It's one of those cities. It's a city that has a lot of, there was a precedent to it.
Okay. It wasn't quite as random as it seems to me.
No, it wasn't so random. It was like there was a lot of people who looked like us in Bradford. And also Bradford subsequently suffered some of the worst racial riots and stuff in the history of the country later, years later, you know. It's an interesting place. It was a kind of a lightning rod for a lot of political immigrant sort of stuff, you know, that got stirred up by the various political parties in the UK.
Interesting. Do you feel like some of your work later on, where you were examining some of the, what did that come from there, do you think? Or was that more the United States?
No, I think that was more here. I mean, I definitely experienced racism in England, you know, very early on. Like, there was definitely an anti-immigrant sort of thing in the politics of the 1970s in England, with like the National Front and Enoch Powell and all these people who were very much your sort of anti-immigrant people. So there was definitely that. Mm. And my dad, I think, dealt with that because he had a little corner shop akin to like a bodega here in New York.
Right.
But it was interesting because it was all sort of like, you know, today you think about that stuff and you go like, that's horrible. But back then it was like, it was sort of thought of as just the price you paid for being an immigrant. You know, like you just sort of took it as like, oh, that's all in a day's work. So there was that sense of otherness that I always felt that then probably was in all the work I did in some ways, but then most noticeably in The Daily Show, I think it was like, I got to really kind of address that in some ways, or like deal with it, even though it was years later and it was much more about post 9/11 in America and all the racial shit that was going on in this country at that point. But probably on some level, the America post 9/11, when I was started on The Daily Show, resembled a little bit of, there was some memory of like the sort of racial stuff that I dealt with as a kid in Bradford, just getting chased home from the bus stop, you know?
Wow.
Just for being brown.
Right, right. Was that a reason when you were 16 that you moved to Tampa looking for something else? I mean, I read that your dad said it was because there was brunch in the United States. That's what I heard. But
so that is part of it is that my dad discovered brunch and was like, this is the greatest thing ever. And actually wrote about it in my book. And it was like, it was such a funny thing because I remember him talking about brunch. This was the 80s and there was no brunch in the UK. Like there was no such thing as brunch. And he misunderstood it. I think he thought what it was another meal. So I think he thought like you have breakfast, like in England, you have breakfast, you have lunch, and then you have dinner.
Right.
Whereas in America, you have breakfast, then you have brunch, then you have lunch. Then you're,
right.
So he was like, you get a whole extra meal over there. Like,
did he feel cheated in the end when he realized that he was actually taking two and one and it was less meal now?
Right. I think later in life, later after he moved here, I think he was kind of like, oh, okay. But he still did like the idea that it was $7.95 all you can eat. Like it was that, it was back in the 80s. So that was what it was. You know, you go to IHOP and you just like the buffet is like, you know, I think there was that. And then I think it was also just that we were living in sort of an England at the time, Thatcher's England, you know, it was Thatcher. And it was a recession, the economy. My dad was a small business owner. It wasn't doing that well. And he'd always wanted to get out of England at some point.
Okay.
His original dream was to move to Canada. I don't know why. I've never actually asked him about that. Like he always was like, we'll live in Canada one day. It was so random. It's like, one day, we won't always be living here. One day, we're going to live in Canada.
We're going to go to Canada. Well, it was just another really cold place.
Yeah, I know. I don't think he realized that. I don't think he realized that. I think he had a friend who lived in Canada and liked it. So he was like, oh, we'll live there. But then he found a friend who lived in Tampa, Florida. And this friend was like, Tampa's even better than Canada. It's sunnier. And this was in the 80s, so Florida was like a place that you wanted to live, not like now, you know? Like it wasn't, like back then, it was like, it was the fastest growing state in the union. There were businesses, it was just like this really developing place, you know? And so the idea was you could make a fortune in Florida, you know? So,
yes. Thank you. Everyone from Florida just tuned out, by the way, but thank you for that.
I'm from Florida and I have a complicated relationship. Like Florida is where I spent many of my formative years. So I love it. And I also have a healthy critique of the place.
Yes. Was it more racially diverse than Bradford or did you know?
No. Well, it was. The joke I made about it was that, like, This was the difference between being an immigrant in England and being an immigrant in America at that time. And that was that in England, the idea was that no matter how hard you tried, you would never be English. That was the sort of the message that was sent to you. And I think it's probably even still true today, which is that you can speak like us, dress like us, talk like us, eat our food, eat fish and chips every day. You can do all that and you'll never really be English, because being English is something. And that, I think, is a legacy of colonialism and sort of like that whole relationship that England has with the subcontinent, which is very specific. In America, on the other hand, I got here in the 80s and went to high school, and I felt like most people couldn't tell you where India was on a map. Like, it was like this idea of like, where are you from? Mexico? No, India. What? Where's that? You know? Is it near Mexico? No, it's not near Mexico. Like, so anything, like, it was like that sense of like, well, don't worry about that. Wherever you're from, I'm sure it's fine. But now you're in the greatest country in the world. You're in America. And so just pledge allegiance to the flag and forget all that stuff. You know, you've got, 5,000 years of history. Forget that.
Right.
Now you're an American. And that was the attitude here, right? Like, just pledge allegiance and just get on board with the American way now. And so then that was it. And,
right.
And it was like nobody really cared. But the racial divide in this country when I got here was between blacks and whites.
Right.
And it was very clear. I remember going to high school, like the first week of high school, and realizing that all the black students sat on one side of the cafeteria and all the white students sat on the other side of the cafeteria. And that was just the way they decided. Nobody was forcing them to do that. That was just
right.
How it went down. This was like self-imposed segregation that was happening. It was kind of an interesting thing. You know, I also fit in with like the drama kids. Like, I found my tribe in the drama kids, who were mostly white, because only white parents were going to be like, you want to do drama? Okay, that's fine. You know, even Indian parents were like, drama. No. You know, but I managed to get away with it.
And when did that start for you? Your interest in theater, when did that start for you?
Oh, very young. I actually was in the school play when I was like 8 years old or something. And then I fell in love with it and realized like, oh, this is going to be, it was very acting and theater and performing. Once I discovered it at a very young age, it was like, that was it. Like, I never looked back. Like, I basically was like, I want to do this. And I didn't know, obviously, like, I had no idea if I was going to be successful at it or anything, or make it a career. It didn't seem like a realistic thing to be able to do that as a career, but I just knew that I loved it. And I have to say, my parents were smart enough, because honestly, I couldn't do anything else. I was terrible at every other subject in school except English and theater. It was like, my parents were smart enough to not discourage it, but also to not encourage it. You know, they were kind of just like neutral about it. My mother, so in my school in England, we didn't have theater. We had art. But she knew that I loved theater because I would go to an after-school kind of kids theater thing on Wednesday nights when I was in England. And I started going there. And it was just like the first time I felt, I mean, I don't know how it was for you, but like, it was just like, I was like, oh, this is awesome. Like, I love doing this, right. You know, and it was funny because I saw the movie Bugsy Malone. Remember that movie?
Okay. Yeah.
So not the one with Warren Beatty.
Oh, not that one. No, then.
No, okay. No. I'm talking about a movie called Bugsy Malone, which was with a very young Scott Baio and a very young Jodie Foster.
No, I don't know this movie.
You don't know this movie?
Oh, no, I don't know this movie.
Check it out. It's a treat. It's basically a gangster movie, but it's all kids. And it's done totally straight, but the kids come in with guns. And instead of shooting bullets, they're shooting pies.
Okay.
But it's done completely straight. Like, it's not like campy or send up or anything. It's like a straight up gangster movie, but everybody in the movie is like 14 years old.
Okay.
And I just remember it was on TV Christmas Eve when I was like about the same age as the characters in the movie.
As the kid, yeah.
And I watched it and I just thought, that is the greatest thing. Like, wait a minute, they get to do this? And like, that's what they do? And they were the same age as me. And I was like, why am I not doing that? Like, it's so fun.
Right.
And that was like weirdly when I decided, like, I want to do that. I want to be in a movie where I get to like, you know, shoot pies in people's faces and just pretend to be a gangster and do all this stuff. And that's when I sort of like got involved with this after school theater program. And then it just all kicked off from there for me. Really.
The journey to a smoke-free future can be a long and winding road. But if you're ready for a change, consider taking Zyn for a spin. Zyn nicotine pouches offer a fresh way to discover your nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. No smoke, no spit, and no lingering odor. Ready to start your new journey? Get in gear with the Zyn 10 Challenge. Enjoy Zyn nicotine pouches for 10 days and discover a fresher way to experience nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. Here's how to get started with the Zyn 10 Challenge. Simply pick your strength and varieties online and check out. Once your Zyn nicotine pouches arrive in the mail, enjoy pure nicotine satisfaction at your leisure. After your 10-day trial, let us know what you think. If Zyn isn't for you, no hard feelings. It's that simple. Order online at Zyn.com, that's Z-Y-N.com, to start your new journey today with the Zyn 10 Challenge. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
You went to the University of South Florida studying theater then. By then, are you thinking, because before you said you weren't sure about doing it as a career, but by then, were you settled that this is what you wanted to do?
Well, again, so I went to the University of South Florida because I had shitty grades.
Okay.
Here's the thing. What happened was we came to Florida and there was a big transition period for me because I was 16 when we got to Florida. It was like I was a junior in high school and I was adapting to this new world and this new country and life, and everything was different. And I think my academics just sort of like fell off. And the only saving grace I had was theater class, was drama class. And so I like lived for fifth period every day, which was drama class. And that's where I like got to like just, you know, do what I did. So my grades were terrible, but because I sucked on my SATs, I ended up getting a theater scholarship to the University of South Florida. So the only way they would accept me was if I was a theater major.
Right.
And they gave me what's called a freshman incentive scholarship. So they would pay for my entire freshman year, but I had to be a theater major.
Okay.
And my parents had just moved to this new country. They were struggling. They were trying to figure out, like, you know, how to survive in this new place. And so I had this, they basically said, look, I didn't get into USF, but I got in, you don't have to pay my tuition. And they'll pay my tuition if I am a theater major. And so sometimes it's just like destiny just fucking leads you
right
down the path that you're supposed to go on. And this is just one of those moments where my parents were like, okay. They weren't happy about it, but they were also like, if they're going to pay for it, then great. And I was like, they're going to pay for it. So I became a theater major and then just stayed a theater major. And that was, you know, and I just went through the program there, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And that's where I learned, you know, I did all my Chekhov and Ibsen.
Right. Did you begin writing then as well?
I actually started writing when I was really young. I actually was always writing stuff. I was also always writing, like, I wrote a short play when I was like 13 years old. And then I would write poetry. I was that kid who would write poetry. Talk about an artsy-fartsy kid. Like, I literally, like, I would write poetry, and then people would come over, like, my parents would have dinner parties or have their friends over, and then their friends' kids would come over. There was, like, a big South Asian community in Bradford, so the kids of my parents' friends would just become my friends by virtue of the fact that our parents were friends, right? It's the opposite of what happens now, which is, like, you become friends with people because your kids are friends. This is, like, the opposite, you know? These kids will be like, hey, you want to go kick a ball around or something? And I'd be like, no, but let me read you some of my poems that I wrote. And I would like, they'd be like, why don't you and so-and-so go and play together? And they want us to go to the backyard or whatever and just play. And I'd be like, come in my room. And I'd pull out like my tray of poems I'd written from under the bed. And just like, and I just remember like some poor kid sitting there, like some poor girl who was like my age, who was the daughter of some friends of my parents, just having to sit there and listen to me like read my poems to her, you know, like a completely dorky thing to like, I was like, what do you think? And then they'd be like, I don't have any thoughts about it at all. Like, so anyway, so I was always writing. And then I think when I got to college and stuff, then I was writing a little bit more and sort of, yeah, writing was always, I was always doing it. I was always sort of writing something.
Right. So you're doing Ibsen and Shakespeare and Chekhov in college, and then you go work for Disney, right? You were a performer at Disney World? Is that your first job?
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you like Mickey? Were you like Mickey Mouse?
I'll have you know, Brian, that Mickey Mouse is a girl. So.
Oh, really? Always?
It's always a girl. Because Mickey Mouse is very short. Mouse, they don't usually find boys that short. So it's often a young girl. Mickey and Minnie are both often young girls. Because we actually shared a trailer. Like, so when I got the job at Disney, it was at the MGM Studios. And I was actually with all these like comedy improv people.
Okay.
And we would do like comedy improv stuff. And it was actually kind of great. It was like a really great, it was like, because I left school to go do that job. I didn't graduate. And I left because at the time we were still not citizens of the United States. So I was still paying out of state tuition. And my parents, because now I was like 3 or 4 years in, my parents were working, but we weren't doing that well. We were very, very lower middle class, like sort of, you know. And so I was paying for like, I was taking like one class a semester. So it was taking me a long time to get through school. And then I get this job where Disney MGM Studios is opening up in Orlando and they're hiring actor, comedians, performers, not like Mickey's and Minnie's and Goofy's. They were like looking for like comedy people because they wanted to do this, like they wanted to have a comedy troupe. And so me and all of my friends, we all went and auditioned. We all drove to Orlando and we auditioned. And I remember I auditioned with this Eric Bogosian piece that I had been working on in my scene study class. And it was just this piece that I had from his show, Drinking in America.
Okay.
And I did this Bogosian monologue and got this job at Disney MGM Studios. And at the time, they were paying me more money than I'd ever seen. You know, I was making $450 a week.
Okay.
And they were going to get me they were like, I was going to have my own apartment and they were going to put me up, you know, the whole thing. So I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go leave school and drop out of school and go make some money.
Right.
And then the idea was I was going to come back and finish my degree, but I never did. I went to Orlando and started working. So it was like an improv comedy troupe. And the people they hired were from all over the country. So, you know, there were people from like Dudley Riggs and UCB. And in fact, Mo Collins, who later went on to become a cast member of Mad TV.
Yep.
Her and I were both in the original comedy cast at Disney MGM Studios.
That's amazing. I was in Minneapolis doing theater for a while. So I was never at Dudley Riggs, but knew Mo Collins, from Minneapolis. And
So she came from there, and what a genius improviser she is and was and continues to be. But it was like a great training ground for me. Like it was kind of like what The Daily Show was many years later, which is like, I just got to work with these incredibly funny people, you know, and we were all kind of in our early 20s and our careers were all just starting. And, you know, it was Mo, and then there was Peter and Paul Vogt. Paul Vogt, I think, also was a cast member on Mad TV later. There was just all these great people. And I got to work there with them. And we would basically just do improv and play these characters at the Disney MGM studios. And I just learned so much. I just learned so much about comedy and improvisation and timing and all that stuff. It was almost like my grad school, because I never went to grad school and I dropped out of undergrad. And then I went here and Disney and I worked there. And I worked there, and then I worked at Universal Studios down the road. And so I was in Orlando for like a couple of years just doing like the theme park thing. Yeah. And just doing, you know, I worked with, I don't know if you're familiar with SAC Theater. They're like an improv comedy troupe, and they would do a lot of the Renaissance fairs and stuff. So a lot of people who worked at MGM also came from the Ren Fair circuit. So I was doing like Renaissance fairs and all that stuff, and sort of deep in that world for a little while.
Yeah.
So it was great. It was a great training ground for just doing funny stuff, you know?
When did you decide to move to New York? You were there a couple of years?
I was there a couple of years. I started dating a girl down in Orlando, and she wanted to move to New York.
Okay.
And I was done with my contract. I was done with my contract at Universal. And I was like, what am I going to do? I kind of done. I got my equity card. I kind of was like, maybe it's time to like go try my luck in New York City.
And you do a number of shows fairly quickly. Brigadoon, Disgraced.
Well, that was later.
Okay.
That was all later. When I first got to New York.
Okay.
So this was, what year was that? 1993. And the first show that I get, it was like a week after I got to New York, was a show called Saddam. And it was a comedy about Saddam Hussein.
A comedy?
Yeah. It was this weird comedy about Saddam Hussein, and it was in Baltimore, Maryland. So I get to New York. I have an audition for this regional theater gig.
Oh, in Baltimore. Okay.
In Baltimore, right? In New York, I auditioned for it. And it was like a four-character play, and I played an Iraqi soldier who was also a stand-up comic. And
wait.
It was a bizarre. So this was the first show that I got in New York. And then I go to Baltimore for like 4 weeks, and we do this play, Saddam, a comedy in two acts. And it was like, so we're doing this show. And the same guy that owns the cabaret space also owns the nightclub next door.
Okay.
So in the middle of the show, he would open up the nightclub. So we'd be like in the middle of this play with like cabaret audience, people drinking, whatever you have. And then suddenly like the wall would just be like, and we were like, dude, you can't do that. Like, we were fucking being drowned out by this noise coming in from the club next door.
Right.
And he was like, no, man, because he owned both spaces and he didn't want to like lose any money. So he was just like, I'll just open the club. So anyway, that was it was crazy. It was like, and then we're competing against this like dance music coming through the walls. And so that was my first gig.
So you were really living that New York theater actor life. Like, you're doing regional theaters and...
Yeah, I was doing the regional theater gig. I was doing Shakespeare. I did the North Carolina Shakespeare Festival. Mm-hmm. I did like, you know, Saddam, the comedy in two acts in Baltimore. I did... and I was doing like off Broadway stuff. You know, I was getting up at like 5 o'clock in the morning and standing. It used to be back in those days, you'd get up and you'd go to Actors Equity and you'd stand in line outside Actors Equity at like 6 o'clock in the morning with your bagel and your cup of coffee. And you'd get an appointment to just have an audition for some assistant of some casting director just to get seen for like, for Pippin in like in Oklahoma or something, you know, like,
right.
And so that was it. And then, you know, you do these open calls. And so that's the life I was living for a long time, where I was just like trying to just get like a gig here, a gig there, like maybe get a commercial. I was doing extra work for a while. I was an extra on a bunch of movies.
Okay.
And so like, I was literally getting my, like my SAG insurance just done by doing extra work for like a couple of years. You know?
Well, I saw Brigadoon, Oklahoma on your resume. Do you sing?
So I don't sing. I mean, let me paraphrase that. I sing well enough to like be an actor who can sing, but I'm not like a singer. Like I don't like have like a Broadway singing voice. So Oklahoma came much later. Oklahoma came in 2002. And by then I'd already done my one man show and all this stuff. And that was, you know, like my big break, right? I was doing did my one man show and stuff. And then I got Oklahoma, and it was the weirdest thing, because I had done my one man show. I'd gotten a lot of attention for it. I did this movie with Ismail Merchant, with Merchant Ivory, called The Mystic Masseur. And I was thinking like, okay, now my career is, I'm going to do movies. That's what I'm going to do. Okay. This is going to be it now. And so I went out to LA, and the phone's not ringing. Nobody saw Mystic Masseur. It was like a movie that nobody saw it. Like nobody cared, you know, like, you know. And so I'm sitting in LA and I'm thinking like, all right. And then the phone rings and my agents are like, you have an audition for Oklahoma on Broadway. And I was like, what? And they were like, yeah, they want you to read for The Peddler. And it's a non-singing comedy role, right? There's a song, but it's like a patter song. It's like a da 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 da, 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 you know, you can talky sing it, right?
Talk sing. That's my forte.
That's your forte.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk singing. Yeah.
I'm great at that.
You talk in rhythm. You just talk like, you know, 20 minutes ago, I am free like a breeze, free like a bird in the woodland wild, free like a gypsy, free like a child. I am unattached. It's just that kind of, you know. So anyway, Trevor Nunn was directing Oklahoma on Broadway. It was the National
Brush
Theater.
Up your Shakespeare. Start setting it now. Yes, I'm great at that.
Yeah. Hey, there you go. So you're great.
Yeah.
So that was, yeah, so they were like, you know, they want to read you and they want you to do like a song. So anyway, I sent in a tape from from LA. And then they said, oh, you have a callback and they want to see you. So then I came back to New York and read for Trevor Nunn, who couldn't have been nicer and was just great. And they were bringing the production that had done at the National Theater was with Hugh Jackman as Curly. And Shula Hensley, who went on to win the BAFTA and then the Tony in New York. So then the production in New York was with Patrick Wilson as Curly. And they had sort of lost some of their British cast. And so they needed to recast it with Americans. So I auditioned for The Peddler and I got the part. And I was just, it was like I was funny. So like they were like, great.
Right.
I think the problem was that the guy in England was not very funny. And they wanted it to be funnier. So they were like, okay, we don't care if you can sing. And I remember going in for my audition with Susan Stroman, of all people.
Okay.
And she was the choreographer. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, listen, I'm not a dancer. And I told my agent, I'm not a dancer. Like, I was a Michael Jackson impersonator in high school, but that's about it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I'm not this Oklahoma dancing. I don't do that. Like my body doesn't move that way. And so they were like, don't worry about it. And so like, I go in and I just shit the bed in the dance audition. And I thought, that's it. That's never happening. And then they called me and they were like, and they don't actually care if you can't dance. They just want you to be funny. And so I was like, well, that's good. You know, so it was great. And I ended up doing that for a year. It was the greatest time. You know, I can honestly say like I've been fortunate to have a very diverse career.
Yeah.
You know, like I've gotten to do a lot of things that you wouldn't expect, you know, but I never expected to be in a musical, no less two, because then years later, City Center was doing Brigadoon and Patrick Wilson was starring in it again. And he said, oh, there's this comic sidekick character who's like a great part. There's no singing. It's just got to be funny. And they were like, why don't we get Austin? So, you know, by then, like people knew who I was. So they got me to do that.
Now, I'm going to be honest. I'm going to be totally honest.
Oh, here we go.
A big musical guy, as I displayed. I don't sing that well. I saw you in Oklahoma. I don't remember much.
Oh, my God.
But Shuler, who I don't really know, so I'm not going to pretend, but he went to my high school.
He did?
He was older than me. Yeah, he was older than me. So yeah, I didn't know him in high school. But yes, I saw the production with Patrick and with you. Yeah. I didn't know you at the time, but I knew Shuler. And yeah.
Wow.
I was there. I was one of those
trillion
audience members.
Yeah, yeah. I just remember we had a rehearsal once and Trevor, you know, we were in the Gershwin Theater, which is that ginormous theater right there on 52nd Street. And it's concrete, right? So it's one of the few concrete theaters in Broadway houses. Like it's not like the Broadway houses, for those of you who don't know, like they're acoustically beautifully built. So the sound bounces, but the Gershwin is not. The Gershwin is like a sound black hole, you know, it's just like, and so it's just like concrete, which just absorbs the sound. So you really got to project. And it's also the biggest Broadway theater on Broadway. It's like 2000 seats or something. So you really got to hit that back wall, you know, you got, and everyone's mic'd and, you know, in those musicals and stuff. So, right. I remember Trevor giving a note to the cast. He was like, it was like after, like, I think our first dress rehearsal or something. And he said, you know, in his very proper English, he was like, now everybody really just needs to just hit that back wall. I know you're mic'd, but really it's a very large theater. You just really just have to get all the way to the back of the house. Everybody, every last seat should hear clearly, crystal clear. So everyone, make sure you hit that back wall. Except you, Asif. You're fine. You can bring it down a bit.
Actually, that sounds like every director that I ever had as well. You and I would have competed, I think. Yeah. You and I would have competed for sure.
I was like, okay. You might be overacting a little bit, but it was so much fun. It was so much fun to do that. And then getting to work with Patrick again years later and also Kelly O'Hara, who I'd never worked with. But yeah, it's weird. I'm not a musical theater guy either. You know, full disclosure, I don't even really go to musicals that much. But I have to say, being in a musical was just a blast. It was just the greatest
fun thing
to do.
I'll share with you, I was doing theater in Minneapolis. You know, summer was usually, there wasn't a lot going on. And I got offered an opera in Northern Michigan. And I was like, I don't sing. I can't do it. And they were like, no. I think it was Die Fledermaus. And there's like a 15-minute or something just set piece, a drunk jailer that comes in, does his like shtick for 15 minutes and then falls asleep in the cell or whatever. And then everybody keeps singing again. But there's like 15 minutes of just one character acting on the stage.
Right.
And I did that. And I'll tell you, it was the most fun job because I could show up like in the middle of act two, go in, do my little thing and then move along.
It was a good time. It was just like a lot of fun.
If you're a smoker or dipper looking to make a change, you really only need one reason to do it. But with Zyn nicotine pouches, you can find many. Not only did Zyn create the first ever nicotine pouch, we're still America's number one choice for smoke-free, spit-free nicotine satisfaction. It could be because Zyn is made with only 6 simple ingredients, including naturally derived nicotine salt. Or maybe it's because Zyn is the only nicotine pouch with a 10-day trial. For anyone worried Zyn won't cut it like traditional tobacco, just ask one of the millions of people who have achieved lasting change. You have lots of options when it comes to nicotine satisfaction, but there's only one Zyn. Find your Zyn online or in a store near you at zyn.com/find. That's zyn.com/find. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow the Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
So during this time in New York, I saw your resume and I was like, oh yeah, no, he was doing the New York thing. Law and Orders.
Every Law and Order.
Multiple times.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Doing all those shows in New York. So through theater, through, I assume, commercials, but also film roles. And as you said, you know, early on doing extra work, you know, you were making a living as an actor.
Yeah, mostly. The good thing was it was steadily, I was getting like better parts, and you know, I was also supplementing my income with cater waitering.
Okay.
But I was getting enough, like I would get a commercial every now and then, or I'd get like a small theater gig. Later I started getting small parts in movies. And it was just sort of like my resume was slowly just starting to build. And I think it's what kept me going. I think if I had stalled out or felt like I wasn't getting anywhere, you know, I don't know what I would have done. I might have ended up going back to Tampa or whatever, you know, like, but it was enough to keep me, like, I was like, and honestly, like, I was living in this place in Long Island City, Queens, where I had like one room and I was sharing this apartment with these South American grad students. And I was basically had one room and I shared the bathroom and the kitchen with these grad students. And it was in this building that was like, right there in Long Island City. And I was paying $300 a month in rent for that one room. And had it not been for the fact that my rent was, it was very, and even 300 bucks a month, sometimes I was like, I can't, you know, it was that scene with Will Ferrell and the little girl, you know, I was like, I can't afford the rent. She's like, you have to pay the rent, you know, but I managed to survive, you know, I managed to somehow just keep stepping up the ladder a little bit. And then I started getting bigger opportunities and then bigger things started to come my way. You know, I think the first sort of real thing that I got was in 1994, which was a year or so after I came to New York. I was an understudy at Lincoln Center in the play Suburbia by Eric Bogosian, who was like my idol from way back when. And so Bogosian had written this play called Suburbia, and it was with Steve Zahn and Martha Plimpton and Zach Orth and Tim Guinea and all these like New York theater actors. Steve Zahn at the time was like the guy, Josh Hamilton, you know, they were like all breaking out into movies and stuff. Steve Zahn had just done Reality Bites with Ben Stiller and Ethan Hawke. And it was kind of a cool little gig. And I didn't even get in the show. I was the understudy in the show. But, you know, it was better than I did anything else. That, you know, so it was like suddenly I was getting like stuff where I was starting to like move up the ladder. And then the year later, I got like an off-Broadway gig, an off-Broadway play called Death Defying Acts, where I was actually in the show. It was a 3-1 acts written by Elaine May, David Mamet, and Woody Allen. And I was in this play with Linda Lavin. And it was like me and Linda Lavin on stage together for like 10 minutes in the middle of this little one act where I played the delivery guy who was coming to her apartment where she's trying to commit suicide. And so it was like a funny little play by Elaine May that ran for a year or so. And I was doing that. And so it was just like starting to like sort of build stuff and get more and more.
Yeah. You mentioned before you were on The Daily Show.
Yeah.
For almost a decade. Why did you decide to audition for that show, or how did that come about?
I ended up on The Daily Show in a very unusual way, which is not the usual trajectory for people on The Daily Show, because I wasn't doing stand-up. I had done stand-up,
right?
But it wasn't my world, and I had done a one-man show and all this stuff. But I was an actor doing like theater, and they just had written this piece, and they needed a Middle East correspondent, and they didn't have one.
Okay.
And it was written, I remember it was like Tim Carvel wrote this piece. And, you know, Tim Carvel, who's now head writer for John Oliver. And it was all about the Iraq War. And this was 2006. And it was after 9/11. It was really a beautifully written piece of satire and comedy. It was just, I think it's still one of my all-time favorite pieces that I ever did on the show. But they were looking. And so they called my agent. They were like, and I remember that day. It was August 9th, 2006. And, you know, there are those days in your life where your life changes.
Yeah.
You know, not always, but this was a day where my life changed. And I woke up in that morning and I was writing a letter to my ex-girlfriend. It was one of those, "Dear John, like, I'm sorry. Like, you know, I just found out she gotten engaged." And I was like,
okay,
still holding on to some idea that we were going to get back together. So I write this letter and I'm writing it longhand and I'm sitting and the phone rings. Now my manager was like, "The Daily Show wants to see you for an audition today." And I remember just being like, "Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of sad today. How about tomorrow?" And I was like, I don't feel great today. I'm kind of really in a miserable place. And they're like, "Tomorrow? I don't think so. It looks like if they don't, they're going to find someone today or not. Oh, that's it." And I was this close to not going because I thought it was going to be like some stupid thing where, you know, like I'd done these on Letterman and other places where I go down and I pretend to like do the voice of some terrorist or something, or on a flying carpet or something, you know, like some weird thing where they put a turban on me or some shit. Then they pay you like a couple of $100 and you go home, you know? I thought, yeah. Oh, this is fucking bullshit. Like, I don't want it. And so I said to my manager, I was like, "What's it for?" And they were like, "It's actually for a correspondent." Because originally I said no. And then they called back and they were like, "You know, it's for a correspondent. So just FYI if that changes your mind." And I didn't know if it was like a full-time gig or anything like that. So I was like, "Fuck it, I'll go." So I said, "What time are they seeing people?" She said, "For 4:00. I was like, "I'll be there at 3:45. And at the time I lived on the Upper West Side, The Daily Show taped like 20 blocks down from where I lived. So I just literally just walked down to The Daily Show. And I walk in, there's Jon Stewart, and he's got his corduroys and his sweatshirt, baseball cap. And I watched the show, you know, so I was like, "Oh, cool, Jon Stewart," you know?
Right.
And, I remember they gave me the sides and there was all this stuff. And I was like, "Oh my God, I got to memorize all this right now." And then I was like sitting there trying to memorize it. And then they came out and they were like, no, it's on the teleprompter." And I was like such a theater snob. I was like, "Teleprompter? Like, oh, this is fucking bullshit." Like, so I literally was just like, "All right, fine, fuck it, whatever." So I just go in there. And honestly, it was one of those moments where I really was like, "I'm not going to get this." And I was like, "If I don't get it, who cares? If I do get it, great," you know?
Right.
And it was one of those moments where I just didn't care. So I literally just went in and I read the teleprompter and I did the bit with John. And John was super nice. And he was like, you know, and I remember him saying to me, like, "Have you ever performed in front of a live audience before?" Because, you know, the Daily Show tapes in front of a live audience. So he was like, "Have you ever performed in front of a live audience?" And I remember just looking at him being like, "Dude, I've been on Broadway." and he was like, "Oh, okay, Mr. Broadway." he's like, "Let's see what Mr. Broadway has got." And then I did it, and I literally just did my best Stephen Colbert impression. Like, that's all I knew how to do. Like, I was like, I'd watch the show, I kind of would watch Stephen Colbert, I'd watch Carell, all these guys, you know, and Helms and everyone. And I was like, "All right, I'll just do that. I'll just do what they do." So I just did it. And then John was like, after the thing, he looked at me and he stood up and he was like, "Dude, congratulations. Welcome to The Daily Show."
He just said it right away?
Yeah. He just like said, "Welcome to The Daily Show. You're going to be on tonight." And now, to be fair, it was a one-off gig, right? It wasn't a contract. So it was like a one-off gig.
Okay.
And he was like, "You're going to be on the show tonight." And I was like, "All right." He was like, "Are you busy?" I was like, "No, of course not." And so that night, I'm on The Daily Show. I'm taping at like 5:00. I go off for rehearsal and they, you know, I don't know if you've ever been to the show, but like basically before they do the taping, there's a rehearsal with the producers and stuff. and the writers. So the writers and producers sitting out there, and I see this guy sitting in the audience with a baseball cap on, and I'm looking at him, and I'm staring, and I'm like, I know that guy. And it's Bruce Springsteen.
What?
And yeah. And so Springsteen, he's a big fan of the show, loved John. John, you know, like huge Springsteen fan. So he just came by to see the taping, and he just brought his son. And so the two of them are just sitting in the rehearsal because they let him in early so he wouldn't have to deal with the crowds and stuff. So like he's sitting in the audience, and I'm like, are you fucking kidding me right now? And then I go backstage, and I'm like, and I remember talking to the crew, and I was like, guys, do you know that Bruce Springsteen is out there? And they were like, yeah, we know. And I was like, is that like a normal thing here? Like you just have like mega stars just show up and sit in a rehearsal? And they were like, no. They were like, a couple of weeks ago, J.K. Rowling was here, but nobody knows what she looks like. So she was totally fine. And so that night I taped the show. Then we get done. It was a great piece. It was like a phenomenal. I can take no credit for it except for the fact that I performed it and did it and sold it. And John, I think, was really happy with it. I went backstage after the show. John's like, stick around. I want you to come into the, they have a post-mortem room where they go over the show afterwards. John was like, come back. I want to, you know, hang out. So I go in the post-mortem room. All the writers and everybody is sitting around like discussing how the show went. And as I'm walking out, Springsteen is in the hallway waiting to say hi to John. And he sees me and he puts out his hand. He's like, hey, you did a really good job. I heard it was your first time. And I was like, yeah, it was my first time. It was so weird. And that was the day. That was the day because then everybody was just calling me like, what the fuck? There was just a guy that looked like you on The Daily Show. And I'm like, no, it was me. It was like, because I didn't even have a chance to tell anyone.
Right.
I didn't tell my parents. I didn't tell anyone. And then there was an article the next day in the LA Times because I was the first non-white correspondent on the show. And wow. I remember this article was like, The Daily Show has this brown guy on there. Like, what the fuck is going on? Like, you know, they've gone diverse. And then John just really liked me. And he was like, you know what? I'm just going to call you back if we need you again. And then they just kept calling me back. And every couple of weeks, I'd go down and do a taping. I would just get paid whatever for the day or whatever. And then after about 4 or 5 months of that, John offered me a contract on the show. And then the rest is history, as they say. Like, it was just like, and that really did that moment. Like, there was definitely a switch where my career went from one point to another, you know, maybe like for you, probably on The Office or something. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Like it was just suddenly like, boom. And the weird thing was that because on The Daily Show, they used my real name.
Right.
People would call me by my real name. And I just remember like realizing like, oh, the impact that this show is having in terms of like its zeitgeist. Because I'd been on stuff. I'd done, like you said, Law and Order and all the TV shows. I'd done movies. I'd done stuff. But I'd never been on anything that had the level of like cultural penetration
right.
that The Daily Show had. And I remember going to a play and Danny DeVito was standing outside the theater waiting with his family or whatever. And I'm walking into the theater and Danny DeVito turned around and looked at me and went, Asif, how you doing? And put out his hand. That was like a moment where I was like, oh, wow, what the fuck is going on? Like, this is like, that had never, you know what I mean? Like, that's when I suddenly was like,
right.
Oh, there are people in Hollywood watching this show that can change the course of where my career goes.
Well, what's interesting is that you didn't just stick in the Daily Show lane. I mean, the number of projects that you have done and the diversity of projects have been amazing. Drama, creating your own work. After The Daily Show, you had the Funny or Die sitcom, Halal and the Family.
Yeah.
And it's been amazing to see you take the platform that you were given by The Daily Show and have done, you know, such a diversity of projects.
I think that at the end of the day, I think I am an actor and always had done a lot of dramatic work prior to The Daily Show. I think what happened with The Daily Show was it was such a, you know, like I said, like a zeitgeist thing that people suddenly thought of me as a comedian. They were like, oh, you're The Daily Show right. comedian guy. When the reality is like, I'd done a lot of dramatic work prior to it. And when I did The Daily Show, actually, while I was on The Daily Show, I did Disgraced at Lincoln Center, which was the Aya Akhtar's Pulitzer Prize winning play. And I played Amazing. The lead role in that. And it was yeah. an incredibly dramatic thing. And I got to do some movies and stuff and you know, all this stuff. But I always felt like my career has always been one where I've gotten to go back and forth. And the writing, you know, I wrote a movie and I produced and starred in it. And
a book.
And wrote a book. Yeah, I think going all the way back to early in my career, there was never a specific lane for me. You know, like I never felt like I had a lane. And because I didn't have that, because there wasn't a space when I first started out, you know, like I went to LA, I remember, and just sat in my apartment and people were like, there's no parts for you. And as a brown actor, the only way for me to work, and that's when I wrote Sakina's Restaurant, which is my one man show, like it was out of necessity of like writing characters that I, so it was always that thing of like, I just always had to be kind of entrepreneurial about the whole thing. So I think it's part of that DNA of just like always going, okay, what can I create? And you know, that continues to this day where I feel like I'm always thinking about like, okay, what can I create? What can I write? Can I do? And, you know, and
right.
Yeah.
Well, Sakina's Restaurant, by the way, your one man show won an Obie.
Yeah.
And got you a lot of attention for that. As I said, Halal and the Family as well. And your book, No Land's Man. That book gave you, I wrote a book. Welcome to Dunder Mifflin was my book. Yours talked about your acting career, your experience on The Daily Show, and your life as an immigrant. And as we talked earlier, a lot of the material about the post 9/11 days, but also your life in England as well and where you came from, right?
Yeah. I mean, the book was sort of, while I was on The Daily Show and had that platform, a publisher approached me and said, have you ever thought about writing a book? At that point, I hadn't. And I thought, well, it'd be kind of a fun thing to do. I'd written a one-man show. And so I thought, yeah, I could write a bunch of short stories. Little did I know, it's not as easy as you think. No. And it was like, you know, I mean, you know. So it's like you think, oh, yeah, I got 10 short stories in me, for sure. I can write that, I can bang that out in a couple of months. Cut to like 2 years later and I'm like fucking writer's block and I'm sitting there and my publisher's calling me up going like, we really should get something soon, right? Like, you know, but I had an amazing editor and it was definitely a lot of work, but I'm so proud of it because it was like, it was really, you know, it was a book that I didn't even know was in me. But
that's awesome.
Once I started excavating, I realized like, oh, these stories that I want to tell, you know?
That's great. Well, and your career keeps growing and expanding in new directions. Now, Evil just got picked up, right, for a third season?
Yeah, Paramount Plus. We're on Paramount Plus now. Yeah, third season coming out. We're in the middle of shooting it right now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that's we're almost done with the third season. And so it comes out in June. I have to say, I'm fortunate. I mean, when you get to work with, like, really great creatives, you know, you know this, like it makes everything just better, you know, like you just, cause you feel like you're in good hands and you feel like you're being taken care of and the writing is good, you know? And I felt that way when I was on The Daily Show working with John, and now working with Robert and Michelle King, you know, who are just at the top of their game and, you know, and it's just such a treat to get to work with them and learn from the way they work. And then also just work with the actors on the show, you know, Katja and Mike and Christine and Michael Emerson, who's a delight to work with. And so it's just everybody on the show just feels like we're just having a good time. Even though we're making this very dark, sort of weird show, it's so fun. And so it's like weirdly absurd and also dark and horror and comedy. It's kind of an amalgam of all of that, which I love. Yeah. And that's what the Kings do so well. It's been great. And they've given me some nice fun stuff to do. So it's been great. And then I'm also producing Would I Lie to You with the Kings, which is also coming out on the CW, which is the panel show.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Which we'll have you on at some point. It's basically, we're doing the American version of the British panel show, Would I Lie to You? It's been on for 14 years.
Yeah.
And we're doing it. It's basically just celebrities coming on and telling wacky stories and other celebrities trying to figure out if they're telling the truth or telling a lie. And it's just hilarious and super fun. And actually, I don't know, do you know Matt Walsh? Do you know Matt?
Of course. Yes, of course.
Yeah. So Matt is one of our team captains with Sabrina Jalice as the other team captain. And we just had the best time. And that comes out in April 9th, next week.
Oh, yeah. Congratulations. I will definitely check that out.
Yeah.
Asif, we hadn't met before, but you are an amazing storyteller, as funny as I expected, and deep and interesting. I appreciate you coming on so much and talking to me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure spending however long we spent together.
Yeah.
That was really fun. Thank you so much. This has been great.
Asif, although we had never met until today, I feel like I've known you for years. And maybe that was because I saw you in Oklahoma. But either way, it was an honor. Thank you so much for stopping by and talking to me. And thanks to you for tuning in. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And give us a follow over on Instagram at OffTheBeat. I can't wait to see you back right here next week. Have a good one, everybody.
Off the Beat is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our producers are Diego Tapia, Liz Hayes, Emily Carr, and Hannah Harris. Our talent producer is Ryan Papa Zachary. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by my great friend, Creed Bratton, and the episode was mixed by Seth Olansky.
If you're a smoker or dipper looking to make a change, you really only need one reason to do it. But with Zyn nicotine pouches, you can find many. Zyn is America's number one nicotine pouch. It's made with only 6 simple ingredients. Plus, Zyn is the only nicotine pouch with a 10-day hassle-free trial. There are lots of options when it comes to nicotine satisfaction, but there's only one Zyn. Find your Zyn online or in a store near you at zyn.com/find. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.